This podcast is brought to you by Wildflower Zen Sangha. This Dharma talk was given by Roshi Amy Hollowell.
Good evening, everyone. Nice to see you all. Seems like a lot of us just saw each other a few days ago during the weekend. Time flies, as we say. And I was thinking, I was busy today and I didn't have much time to consider if I would talk tonight, and if I did talk, what would I say? So as I was sitting, came to me that it's always right here. And I remember the story of the Mullah Nasruddin, who was a kind of a folk tale hero in the Muslim tradition. And there's a story where he was crossing a border regularly. Some people say it was between Turkey and Hungary, but I'm not sure where. At that time, that part of the world was not what we didn't have the borders that we think of today. And the border police, he regularly crossed, like once a week, this border, and with a donkey and things on the back of the donkey. And the border police were convinced that he was smuggling. And so they would stop him, search the donkey, search his packages, nothing. But it was just too weird. But they had to let him go, and so this went on for many years. And then several years later, after one of the border police officials had retired and was doing something else, farming or something, he ran into in a cafe of some kind, an auberge type place. He saw Nasruddin, who was there, drinking with friends and having a good time. So he went over to him and he said, "Listen, it's great to see you. I'm no longer with the police. I work as a farmer. I have nothing against you, but I really want to know. I'm sure you were smuggling. What were you smuggling?" And Nasruddin turned to him and he said, "Donkeys." It was right in front of their eyes, the police. They didn't see it. They were looking for something else. They were looking for contraband, for jewels, for food, anything that he would be carrying on the donkey or in his pockets. Never occurred to him that it was the donkeys. It was right before their eyes. And this is the story of our lives, actually. The story of mine, anyway. like I say, I'm sitting here trying to figure out what I will say, and it's always right here. I don't have to look somewhere else. And our practice is not to... Our practice is just about being right here. And we struggle so much sitting, trying to focus, trying to not be distracted, trying to solve a koan, trying to figure out the best posture, maybe a special cushion, special clothing, a special place, when actually the whole practice is just about being right here with yourself as you are. The donkey. It's right here in front of you. Every moment, all the time. It's right here. On my blog for many years, and it's still there, although I haven't used my blog for a year. In the original version of the blog, which I liked much better than the newer version, but I put a saying, a quote at the top from Huang Po, and it says, "That which is before you is it, in all its fullness, utterly complete." So what's right here in front of you is it. That's what you're looking for. It's absolutely full. Nothing needs to be taken away. Nothing needs to be added to it. Utterly complete. Utter is this word in English that is like completely complete, entirely complete, perfectly complete. And that first time I heard that phrase, reading and studying Huang Po, I said, that's it. That's the whole teaching is right there. And so when I created that blog, I put that at the top. And it's still at the top of the current blog, but it's kind of lost in the complications that we added. The original blog was very simple and in keeping with the technology at the time. And then we decided to get smart and create this, you know, fabulous website, and that simplicity got lost. So the phrase is still there and it still means the same thing. Somehow I kind of got lost away from it. And the phrase is there because that's, for me, is what, that's what the whole teaching is about. The donkeys. That which is before you. The donkey is right there. In all its fullness, absolutely complete. Nothing taking away, nothing added. Doesn't have to be a particular donkey. A donkey doesn't have to be brilliant or stupid or nice or mean, strong, weak, just as it is. And this is hard, we know, because we just are constantly looking for something else, something else, something else. And we have that great great poem, which I also quote often, "The perfect way is not difficult. It just dislikes picking and choosing." And so that's how our perfect way becomes complicated and difficult, is when we start picking and choosing, wanting something else. I remember Genpo Roshi in his first, my teacher's teacher, in his first book. The book is a commentary on that poem. And he would give all these really simple examples. It was the first Zen book I ever read. It was the first Zen book that my teacher allowed me to read. And because it's really simple. And it gives just these really basic, he talks about his life, basically. And Genpo is not an intellectual. He's not someone who's searching for like beautiful turns of phrase or something. He was a beach boy in California, Southern California, you know, like a lifeguard, an athlete, played, you know, competitive water polo, but not an intellectual. And so his way of teaching is very direct and simple. So he gave these examples, you know, like I think one of them was this about picking and choosing. Because we think, oh, if we don't pick and choose, then that means we just, we can't make any choices. We have no choice then. We're forced to do things, or we just accept whatever arises, whatever comes our way. And then, you know, we don't get anywhere and we don't do anything and we won't have any energy to achieve or to study or to grow. And he points out that that's not it at all. And I remember one example was, said, it's like you go into a restaurant and you order a sandwich and you want, he uses the Italian cheese provolone, you want that kind of cheese on your sandwich. And they say, oh, well, we don't have that. We only have cheddar. And so if you are in your habitual picking and choosing and they don't have what you want, you will be very upset and frustrated. And you might even say, well, I won't have a sandwich then because I wanted that other kind of cheese. Whereas if you, the perfect way is, okay, you wanted the other cheese, but they didn't have it. So you take what there is. And, or you say, okay, I'll have a sandwich without cheese, something else, if you really don't like cheddar. And it makes it so much simpler. And you may even discover that you really like the sandwich with cheddar cheese. And probably even before, if you truly realize this perfect way, when you come to order your sandwich, you already won't be attached to having that particular kind of cheese. You will say, oh yes, yeah, I like that. I think I would like that cheese. But if they don't have it, that's no problem. That's the perfect way. It's no problem. It's just what it is. That's the ingredient that is there. And you make your meal with that ingredient. And Genpo is full of really good examples like that. Or I'm reminded of the story of about in our sitting practice when we try to look for something else, when we try to obtain something or try to arrive. There's the Zen story of Seppo and Ganto, who were Dharma brothers in 9th century in China. And their teacher was Toku-san, who appears in our koans a lot, who was a great master. And after he died, they went off on pilgrimage to visit other teachers, Seppo and Ganto. And Ganto was more advanced than Seppo. And they stopped one night on the way and camped out. And Seppo and Ganto woke up during the night, and Seppo was not sleeping. He was sitting, and he had lit a candle and was sitting there meditating. And Ganto said, what are you doing? It's the middle of the night. You're not going to sleep. And Seppo said, oh no, I'm doing meditation. And Ganto said, why aren't you sleeping? And he said, because I have to sit so that I can awaken, or something like that. And Ganto said, you know, I forget the exact phrase, but it was, You will not become enlightened by sitting. Something to that effect. Zazen is not how you will be awakened. When it's time to sleep, you sleep. When it's time to sit, you sit. Sounds easy, but it's not so easy, is it? We always want something else. We always look somewhere else. And I'm the first sitting here on my cushion for 10 minutes thinking, wow, what could I talk about today? What would be helpful? What would have meaning? What didn't I say during the weekend or something? Instead of just being right here with what is. Which is always the best thing anyway. It's the perfect way, as we say. And I was distracted because my kitten arrived today, just like half an hour before sitting. And I had to come and sit. And I would like to have stayed there with her because, she's a little scared and we had to just leave her in her carrying case, opened it up so that she could come out when she was ready. And she had just started coming out to explore a little bit and then ran back inside. So I had to leave. And I would like to have brought her to show her to you, but I don't think it's probably appropriate tonight since she's only been here for half an hour. Next time I'll bring her. But she has a name. We settled on a name. And it's appropriate because it comes from all of you. It's a Zen name. And we're calling her Muji, which is Mu. It's another form of Mu. So her name is Muji, a Zen cat. And she's not looking for something other than what is, In fact, she's very much in not knowing. She doesn't know where she is. She doesn't know what that room is we put her in and then where she has ended up and coming in the car and can we have that kind of, can we be in that beginner's mind? Just look at what's here right in front of us and explore it, discover it. So, anyone like to say anything? Questions, comments, participation of any kind?
I believe it's very difficult for you to sit here with us, to be present when the Muji is outside. I appreciate that very much. I can imagine. Yeah, it's good.
Thank you. It is and it isn't. My practice has been for so long just being with what is that I can move freely from one to the other, without picking and choosing. Of course, you know, I am aware that the cat is in the other room, the kitten, and that I will see her when I'm, you know, in 45 minutes. But really the practice, and I've practiced it for so long and I still practice it over and over and over again, it's just to be here with what is. So this is where I am now, you know, and this is what is. That's the perfect way.
For me, it was so clear in the moment. It was so clear what we need to do to be present. when something call us, and the exercise we do with our mind to do that, and to come here to be present here. Was only so clear.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Joa?
Yeah, what you said about the simple the practice of just it reminded me of brought me back to conversations that I had over the past few days that really touched me and resonated. I was spending time with friends, and I think we were exchanging, particularly one friend was exchanging with us about some realizations that he made about himself. And I think that I was certainly relating to that. And I'm assuming a lot of us can relate to that. It was the difficulty to be really with what is, because we have been trained a certain way. And what he was referring to was what kind of is built in the first years of his life in the relationship with his parents, and the love. It was about the love not being received the way it should have been received, and the inadequacy of the love expressed, and so this lack of love that ends up in certain reactions and representations, and our desire to be loved a certain way and all that. So we're always kind of moving toward that. So it's just that made me think of how my translation of what he was saying was really just our difficulty to rest with what is and stay in this this unreactive space can be is rooted in our experiences and representations, what are called sankharas, what is called sankharas in the Pali canon, and it can be rooted in this fundamental aspect of how we receive the love. So Now I'm thinking of that. I'm saying that out loud, and I'm thinking also that links very much also to what you've said many times. It's all about love. So finding the being okay with what is going on, and also reconnect with that dimension of that dimension of love. And so one of the things actually that we discussed is that this inadequacy of love, I was asking, but do you actually, even though it was totally inappropriate or the way they expressed it should have been something else, are you convinced that, do you believe that they actually loved you? And you said, yeah. But that also, I think that was such a relief to know that, even if parents almost by definition fail in the way they behave, as we fail in the sense that it's never going to match the expectations that children have. And so that's what came up for me. I don't know if I made myself clear, if it's clear, but something like that.
And indeed, our expectations will never be satisfied. So that has to do too with the, you know, if we are not just with what is, expecting something else, it won't happen. It never will happen what we're expecting. So yeah, that's true too. Whether it's our parents' love or becoming a different person, you know, we're not going to be somebody else.
Yeah, and actually, I think for him, he was very interesting. It felt like this coming to terms with the expectations, to realize that he had expectations and to realize that people, it wasn't his fault. It was just, he was thrown into that and he can take responsibility for it. And also comes with empathy, also understanding where people come from and sometimes that the love that wasn't provided is because the people themselves were stuck in their own representations and stuck in their own drama and their own childhood difficulties and things like that. How do we come to rest? How do we
Lisa?
It makes me think of what Corinne Sensei had time, her talk about time and how it's all about here and now, and at the same time, this here and now includes also the past and the future, and somehow I'm far from being able to repeat what she, or let's go into the depth of what she explained, but it's just that in relation to what Joa was saying, and the what who we are and what we are come with and what our childhood was and whatever our story is and what constitutes us, you let go of it, but then it's completely you as well. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it's just this even in the just here and now, in the just it, this it is complete and complete with also that history, whatever. Just
yes, it's and the that is, you know, very profound and vast statement and realization, because if we can truly acknowledge that, that means that we are not fixed. We are not what we think we are. It's not just this fixed identity that we have, because it's changing all the time. It includes everything. What we think of as past, what we think of as future, what we think of as now, that we can't separate. We can't see the beginning and the end. We can't see where the ocean and the beach are cut, you know, where one begins and one ends. We can't see where past and present are. How did we become who we are? If you tried to break it down and trace the evolution, you wouldn't be able to find it. So it's that's a huge statement. And I think Corinne Sensei even was something like, I forget how what she said, but it was to the effect of, you know, just sit with that. Sit with it. Wasn't it something like that? She was telling us at the end, just, I forget exactly what it was that she was saying, just sit with it, but it was something to that effect.
She used this term time being, if I remember correctly.
Whereas that phrase in Dogen is usually translated as being time. But she chose to do time being. I don't know why. I mean, she has her reasons for choosing that. And it does maybe change, because when we think of being time, there's this notion of being fixed, of, you know, so I am that, I am time or something. So anyway, yeah. And I know that she did say that using words to discuss this is really difficult, because instantly we start, even if we, you know, we say, okay, so I am also my past, that too, we start getting caught up in it. But we can think of it like, you know, okay, well, I ate pasta for lunch. Well, I am that pasta, you know, that part of what makes me right now. I am that. And eventually it will pass through me, the waste aspect of it will be passed on, but something of it remains and interacts with other aspects that make me who I am right now. And then that interacts with something else that will make me who I am. That make me who I am the next moment, the next moment, the next moment. That's how we are our past, actually. Mm-hmm. it's all this notion of not of endless motion. No. Really, like the ocean is a really good metaphor because the tides rise and fall, come in, go out, the waves, and yet it's moving and it's always changing, and yet we call it the ocean. And I'm always intrigued by, you know, we have the Atlantic Ocean, the Indian Ocean, the Pacific Ocean. And I don't really know where we draw the line. You know, where I'm sure there's a place, longitude, latitude, where it gets drawn, but the water's the same. Right? Or you have in both in Lisbon and Porto, you know, you have this amazing estuary where the river and the ocean are crashing together there. And I don't really know where one becomes the other. You know, maybe some of you know, like in Lisbon, is there a certain spot where you say, okay, this is the river and that's the ocean?
Lucky that we can build borders in the ocean, in the waters. Because are the same with the heart. Hmm. When we don't have borders, it's all one.
That's right, absolutely. Yeah. And I guess in the ocean, it's almost more mysterious because it's so fluid. You know, like Britain and France or the EU are having this huge argument about fishing rights. And, you know, the French fishermen, they can't fish in British waters, or they can only fish a certain amount of fish in British waters. Well, you know, it's like, how do we decide where those waters are? I know that they have places where they say this is Britain and this is France, but it's really crazy. But you're right, Sue, it's the same thing on the land.
Yeah, and the sardines are not aware of that.
No, absolutely.
One other language. I speak French, yet.
Right. Whose net is that is going to fish me out and kill me so that they can eat me? They don't care.
They don't care.
That's right.
They are free.
Yeah. João.
Good evening, everyone. On this subject of borders, I was thinking, because we've been talking about last minute's space, I was thinking about time again. I remember this episode in Coimbra a few years ago. We went there for a retreat, and we, as usual, we go there and we set up the place for the Zendo with the altar and the zafus and all that stuff. And then, as you all know, we're supposed to take our shoes off, you know, when the retreat is actually happening or something. And I think maybe someone has, maybe it was myself, I don't remember. Someone hesitated on walking in. And we were still clearly setting the place up. It was more or less, it looked more or less already like a Zendo. Yeah, but then you, Roshi, you asked, at what point does it become a Zendo? Is it already appropriate to take the, so it's also very, of course, at some point it's very obvious that it's a Zendo and it take your shoes at the door. But there's this moment, this period of time when it's not so uh, so obvious. And so at what point does it become a zendo? And it was not a zendo before. Nobody would call it a zendo before, and nobody will call it a zendo some days later. So we just decide, someone decides, or it's also very, and for us it's really interesting, us Wildflower, I mean, because we don't have a fixed place, although the group in Paris had a fixed place in Paris for some time, but usually we don't, so we just, it's a very interesting experience.
That's why we say the earth is our zendo, because
yeah,
it's wherever you are is the zendo. Yeah. Although in Coimbra, when we arrive, that room is full of chairs and desks and whatever else is in there. And we have to move it all, and some of it stays. A lot of it is hidden behind a screen, so we don't see it. But the cross is still there on the wall, and the poster is there with the guy overlooking the horizon. And but it was a zendo before too, but we didn't call it that. It's always, everything is always a zendo. From the absolute point of view, it's true. Yeah, and that's always been our practice at Wildflower. For years and years, so for 3 years we had a center, a dedicated center, but otherwise we never have. And so we've always, you know, for years on Monday nights, Joa and Delphine's living room was transformed into the zendo. We arrived, we moved all the furniture, we took out all the cushions. And then when it was done, we to put away all the cushions and then moved all the furniture back, and it was a living room again. But it was always a zendo, and it's always a living room. And then we've done that at a yoga center, and then we did that at a physiotherapist's office. We did it in Sophie's brother-in-law's business, his office, in the middle of all the desks. And remember that one? Christine and Joa. Lisa, did you ever go to that one? No. Or my living room. It's a great practice. And then, of course, in Portugal, any number of places we've been doing the same thing. And that's it's a wonderful practice. It frees us from picking and choosing. Okay, this is where we are. Sit where you are with what you have. Christine?
When we were in Belgium, in this huge sendo with Michelle's transmission, there were some people who arrived quite late in the week, just for the transmission, or 1 or 2 days before, and they started sitting with us, and regularly they sat on my place. I had that fixed place for almost the whole week, and then there were people who were instructing everybody who where to sit. And I was always really pissed off when my place was not empty anymore. And I had to take another one with sitting with the back towards the room, and something that I didn't really feel comfortable about. And now I can only laugh about myself. I mean, what difference where you sit, you know, getting attached to, this is my place, and how come that these people pick my place? Yeah.
Yeah. But we do. Yeah, definitely.
I was here first.
That's right. Yeah. Whereas, you know, there's something really freeing about wherever you're sitting is your place. Really liberating.
Yeah, yeah, I don't remember if I had that realization still during or only after.
Probably not, yeah.
Yeah.
I had a similar kind of experience when at Frank Roshi's transmission, so I had received a transmission the year before, and I was not happy to be there. I was in a phase where, I mean, I was happy for Frank to be receiving transmission, but I was in a phase where I, you know, kind of like a teenager who didn't want to be there with all these people and with my teacher, and I wanted to be off on my own doing my own thing. And although I couldn't really even verbalize that, but, and as the week, towards the end of the week, of course, when people arrived, same thing, you know, people at the end of transmission weeks, all kinds of people arrive who haven't been there before. And they were all kinds of important people who were arriving, right? People who were much senior to me. And so as they would arrive, I was getting pushed farther and farther. Like, first it was towards the door. And then I was kind of okay with it, because I would have been happy to like been pushed right out of the door. But then it got so like I was being pushed like the other way and around the corner kind of. And I was really, really annoyed. Like, exactly like you, it was kind of like, why are they taking my place? And here, you know, I was trying to like get comfortable with my status, and then what I was clinging to of my status of sitting in a certain place was being taken away. And so then I didn't know who I was anymore, and I didn't want to be there anyway. And I can totally relate. It was really annoying. It was much later, of course, when I could realize that, like I said, didn't matter where I sat. I could be at home wherever I was, but that's a hard realization to come to.
Yeah, and there was Genevieve, who was sitting with us last weekend, and she was one of the placeholders, or, you know, and once she even said, yeah, please be flexible about where you have to sit now. It's a little bit getting crowded and we have to displace people. Please be flexible about it. And I was just, still each morning getting, my place again is taken. Tomorrow I'll come earlier.
To sit in the place before they
yes, before they arrive, so I can have my place.
Right. Yeah, and that's exactly what, you know, the thing of the donkey is right in front of us. Our place is right in front of us. In fact, we are our place. We don't see that. That's the tragedy of our lives, of our existence. It's also a great opportunity because that suffering pushes us to, moves us to seek, where is my place? Who am I? And, you know, like Christ said, seek and you shall find. But we have to look in the right place.
And we can develop so many ideas about what we are or who we are if we don't sit and do this practice. You know, you don't even get aware of patterns like that if you if you just live your life and are always in reaction to what is happening in the world around you, then it's really difficult, I find.
And of course, there are many ways of, our way is just one way, what we call the supreme way, the perfect way. But the perfect way is actually whatever your way is. So other people have, someone else might have another way, and that is a perfect way as well. Okay, well, if no one wants to add anything else, that's the perfect way as it is.
If you have enjoyed this Dharma talk, just give us a visit on wildflowerzen.org.